The Transportation Security Administration, otherwise known as the TSA. Born on November 19, 2001, this criminal arm of the federal government was only the infancy of the police state we now live in. TSA breaks constitutional law countless times every day, in every state, all over America, without the authority to do so. Under the 10th Amendment, airport operation falls under state jurisdiction, not federal. This is just part of the Fed's tyranny over the rights of the American people. It's time to wake up. Stay informed on all of the criminal actions of the federal government at 10thAmendmentCenter.com. Also visit NullifyNow.com for information on 10th Amendment Center conferences in your area. TRX. You're helping you to unlearn what they told you at government school. 10th Amendment Center depends on your support to bring you the best red state sovereignty website in the world. If you support our work, please donate at 10thAmendmentCenter.com/donate. That's 10thAmendmentCenter.com/donate. Tired of the feds reaching into your life? 10th Amendment Center's Intrastate Commerce Act says that anything grown, manufactured, produced, and then sold in the state is off limits to Washington, D.C., period. You can find the Intrastate Commerce Act publicly available at 10thAmendmentCenter.com/legislation. That's 10thAmendmentCenter.com/legislation.
Well, I'm personally very skeptical about any form of regulation of any kind of speech.
And the supreme law of the land, which is the Constitution, which established a footprint for the government, out of which it may not go,
right,
has been violated since day one.
Back in 2005, California made it a crime for retail stores to sell violent video games to anyone under 18. Today, the nation's highest court, in a 7-2 decision, ruled that law is unconstitutional. The games are protected by the First Amendment.
Phil Russo, Michael Bolden back with you on TRX. Video games, can you imagine? There's no stopping the thought police, Michael Bolden. It's just going to keep getting worse. And if they can do it to video games, it could be comic books, it could be any magazine or newspaper, right?
Yeah, you know, I personally think California was dumb to say that these games can't be sold to minors. But the question is, and we'll get Kevin Getzman on here in a moment. Should the federal government have any say in this? I mean, is this up to the federal government? What did the Supreme Court have to say? Well, Phil, take her away. I think we got Kevin with us here.
Kevin Gutzman is the author of the Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution and Virginia's American Revolution, which is the book Tom Wood's Nullification was based on. Kevin Gutzman, how are you, sir?
Very well. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. So we were just talking about the California violent video game ban, and I was asking Michael Bolden, if it can be video games, can it be any magazine or comic book or newspaper or anything?
Well, can what be? Can it be that the court will say that the states can't regulate it? Is that the question?
No, can the states, if they're going to ban the sale of video games to minors, couldn't they ban the sale of anything to minors?
And then I think the question, Kevin, is, who has the authority on this? I mean, if the states want to make a dumb law and ban something, is that up to them? Should the Supreme Court even be stepping in on this? Uh-oh, I think we lost Kevin, so hopefully we can get him back on, Bryce, in the studio.
Oh, I thought he was just like, I don't understand what this guy's talking about.
Kevin Gutzman, are you there? Okay, well,
I'm ringing him through right now. It looks like it just dropped or something, so hang on.
Okay, fantastic. Well, what's going on, Phil? This court case was basically saying, the Supreme Court was saying, California is not authorized to basically ban the sale of something. I don't know if it's necessarily a good idea to ban things, and that probably goes back to the idea that the Constitution is set up where states can be stupid. So the question is should the Supreme Court be stepping in to protect us? Is this the right place? Is this the right guarantor of our liberties, the Supreme Court, so-called, protector of our rights, fixing things and telling the states what they can or can't do? I think it kind of creates a slippery slope and leads to them, claiming authority over other stuff, like saying, oh, well, you can or can't choose to have health care plans or something like that. I think these types of things set bad precedent, but hopefully we'll get back on the air here in a second.
I think when it comes to media stuff like that, if California wanted to outlaw the Los Angeles Times, you wouldn't want the Supreme Court stepping in and saying, no, you can't do that.
Well, I don't know if I necessarily think it's a good thing or a bad thing, but the question is, constitutionally, is it right? Is Kevin Gutzman, are you with us?
I'm here, yes.
Fantastic. So I don't know how familiar you are with this case, but the Supreme Court just ruled that California cannot ban the sale of video games, certain video games, to minors. Now, without necessarily talking about whether that's a good choice by California or not, what's your view on what the Supreme Court has to say about that? Is that a federal decision? Is that a First Amendment decision? What's going on here?
Well, in 1802, then President Jefferson wrote a letter to former First Lady Abigail Adams in which he was discussing this very question. What he said was that, of course, the Constitution leaves regulation of the press to the states where it properly belongs. That is, this question of what video games minors are going to be allowed to buy in your state is one that's supposed to be regulated not by the nine censors in Washington, but by your elected local legislators. And, of course, that's a superior system. But, of course, what we're treated to in this latest opinion is yet another example of Justice Scalia, the phony originalist, once again insinuating himself into what really are supposed to be state legislative questions. So every time you hear him call himself an originalist, you should think, well, yeah, but I know that's not true, because you've said over and over that you're not going to refight this incorporation question. So you're interested in taking control over these issues that were supposed to be reserved to state legislators. That's not the same as saying that you think the law was wise or it wasn't wise, and I don't even think that's even an issue. It's up to people in California to decide.
So, but the Supreme Court, Kevin, they're saying that this is having video games or, what else it can lead to, publications. This is a First Amendment issue. So should this even be considered under the First Amendment, or is this a commercial or a commerce clause question?
Well, again, the point is that the First Amendment is applicable only to Congress, as it was originally introduced, what Jefferson was telling Mrs. Adams in 1802. And nothing's happened since 1802 to change the Constitution in this regard. That is, there was never a point when the people of the states decided, we're just too dumb for this. We'd rather have those really smart Harvard and Yale law school graduates in Washington decide every important question related to child rearing. So we don't want our state legislators to have a say in this issue. We'd rather have Scalia and his cronies making that decision behind closed doors in Washington. So no, of course, it's not a legitimate exercise of judicial authority for them to be striking down this statute. And actually, Scalia himself knows that. What he said about this himself is, I'm not going to refight the incorporation battle. The incorporation doctrine is this bogus judicial invention that's supposed to have made these into federal judicial questions instead of state legislative questions. Scalia knows that it's not founded in history, and yet he said, we're not going to refight it. Or in other words, I know this isn't legitimate, but it's just too darn fun to be able to decide these questions myself, so I'm going to have my fellows on the Supreme Court join me in deciding whether California can have this law, and we've decided we don't like it, so we're going to call it unconstitutional. That's really what happened here.
Phil, you asked a question of me, and I think probably Kevin would be a better person to pose to, about the LA Times, let's say California. Why don't you rephrase that? I don't know if Kevin was on the air when you were asking that, and I think this is a standard question that a lot of people bring up.
Right. Like, so the question is, if California can say, you know, we're going to ban this video game, can where does that stop before the Supreme Court would be right in getting in? Is it if they're trying to ban comic books, or if they're trying to ban magazines, or if they're trying to ban the LA Times? At what point is it like, this is a First Amendment issue and you can't do that?
None of these are First Amendment issues. Again, the First Amendment begins, Congress shall make no law. And in fact, as I said before, President Jefferson pointed out in 1802 that the Constitution left these questions to the state legislatures where they rightfully belonged. There's no reason to think that the government of California is going to ban the LA Times. We are far more likely to have the federal executive banning newspapers, which has happened repeatedly in American history. We had in the 1790s, we had the Sedition Act. In World War I, we had a Sedition Act. During the Civil War, we had President Lincoln throwing hundreds of newspaper editors in jail. That's never happened in California. So people always assume that if people say, well, you know, these questions are reserved to state legislatures to decide, this somehow will lead to tyranny. We'd be far better off having unelected officials in Washington making these decisions. Somebody's got to make the decisions. The question is, should it be the elected legislators that the Constitution says are supposed to decide these questions, or should it be unelected officials in Washington? And the answer that the Constitution gives is, this is supposed to be reserved to elected officials at the state level. That's what the First Amendment, that's what the Tenth Amendment is about. These questions are mainly for people to decide by having an election, not by going and talking to these politically well-connected lawyers who meet in secret in Washington. So,
In our first segment, we were talking about the Bond case a little bit, and like where you might see the implications of that, what kind of lawsuits you might see grow out of that.
Remind me, which one's the Bond case?
That was the case, Kevin, where the Supreme Court said that individuals can actually sue the feds under the 10th Amendment. And I had mentioned, I read actually what you had sent to a few people by email that we posted on the blog, how you mentioned that the Supreme Court, you know, for like 60-some-odd years didn't rule a single congressional statute unconstitutional.
I recall now. Actually, what the Bond case did was it said that individuals have standing to raise 10th Amendment questions when they're appealing their criminal convictions. But, of course, what's going to happen in these cases, even if people are recognized as having standing to make 10th Amendment claims on appeal, what's going to happen is the court is almost always going to say that Congress did indeed have the authority to adopt the statute in question, their reading of the Commerce Clause or the Equal Protection Clause or the Necessary and Proper Clause or whatever. So it doesn't actually go to the limitations or lack of limitation on the powers of Congress that the court has carved out since 1937. What it does is it means that effectively people who are convicted in criminal court can ask the question, does Congress really have power to do this? The courts are still going to say, well, yeah, Congress can do anything it wants, essentially, under our current distended reading of the Commerce Clause or the Necessary and Proper Clause. So I read it as really not much of a victory at all for people who believe in federalism. And the clue that this is that my understanding of the decision is correct is that all nine justices joined in it. And if it were going to have any actual effect on the scale of federal government, then we wouldn't expect all nine justices to join in it.
What's your thoughts, Kevin, at least on the principle or the theory that an individual – some people I've heard actually saying that, you know, this is only a place where states should have standing because under a compact, the states created the federal government, so then they're saying that only the state should be able to do this, and this wouldn't be an individual issue. Do you have any comments on that? What's your view?
Well, certainly I have a comment on that. The states, as the word is used in the Tenth Amendment, are the sovereign people, not the government of the state. It's the sovereign people. So you, as a citizen of your state, are one of the sovereign people of the state, and certainly you should be able to raise any question that might call into question the legitimacy of Congress's enactment under which you're being prosecuted. Yeah, I don't have any problem with that at all. I think, in fact, that individuals should be recognized as having standing to sue on spending issues. But, of course, the court hasn't gotten to that, so we shouldn't expect them to get to that either.
Well, I think, as you probably pointed out so many times, is that we shouldn't expect the court to do much. And actually, there was not, you know, I know we only have you for a short amount of time, Kevin, so I want to try to hit you with as many things as possible to get a few, you know, juicy tidbits of advice. Last week I was on the show, I was talking about something that Michelle Bachmann said, and I know we've got a short clip, hopefully we can get it up here, John Michaels. She was talking about healthcare mandates being, well, John, see, can you run that clip right now?
I firmly am against the individual mandate. I think it is unconstitutional whether it's put into place at the state level by a state legislature or whether it's put into place at the federal level. I think it's unconstitutional. It's unconstitutional. It's unconstitutional. It's unconstitutional.
Kevin, my thought is that people, and I don't know what her real view or motivation is behind that, but I think people tend to miss, you know, they confuse the word unconstitutional with bad. If they think it's bad, then they say it has to be unconstitutional. But the question
right.
I have for you, and I think this is kind of the same thing as this First Amendment case, is a healthcare mandate like Romney signed into law in Massachusetts unconstitutional or not, and why?
Well, it certainly doesn't violate the federal constitution. That is, I heard the two of you conversing about this question before, and I thought you were exactly right. That is, the 10th Amendment stands for the principle that the federal government has limited powers. Some sections of the federal constitution deny specific powers to the states, but other than that, the states can do anything they want. So the federal constitution does not say that Massachusetts may not impose this health care mandate on its citizens. So Massachusetts still can impose this health care mandate on its citizens. And as you said, the fact that I say that Massachusetts had a right to do this does not mean that I think it was wise or moral or desirable at all. In fact, I think it's none of those three. But I think they certainly had a right to do it. So what Bachmann is doing here, I think, sounds a lot like the Supreme Court majority in the first part of the 20th century. It was the opposite of the situation we have now, in which the Supreme Court effectively will allow Congress to do whatever it wants when it comes to the economy. At the beginning of the 20th century, the Supreme Court was saying that it was going to intervene both against state and against federal legislation that had to do with the economy. And in 1937, famously, it got out of that business. So Bachmann, instead of correcting the situation and saying, well, states can do what they want when it comes to the economy, but Congress can do very few things, is wanting to go back to the day when the federal courts were intervening on behalf of laissez-faire against both state and federal legislation. It's a kind of mirror image of what we have now, and it's equally mistaken. It's probably a more desirable position than the one the court stands for now, but it's still mistaken.
Kevin, last week we posed to our Facebook fans, that's facebook.com/10thAmendmentCenter, you know, hey, post a question that we should ask Kevin Gutzman when he's on air. And, you know, we're going to run with it, and I think it kind of ties in with a little bit. I don't know if it's the best question or the worst question, but they say, why aren't people making legal challenges to every unconstitutional law now? Why hasn't, you know, now that this bond case has come up, why isn't there just like a floodgate of lawsuits?
Well, two reasons. Number one is all the court said was that you have standing to bring an appeal if you're convicted on a federal criminal charge. The appeal could be about the constitutionality of the statute under which you've been convicted. So most of us are not being convicted of anything, and that means we have no appeal to bring. Second thing is, though, the one I pointed out to you earlier, which is all the court said was that you have standing to bring this appeal on the basis of the 10th Amendment. But the fact that all nine justices joined in saying that should tip us off that it's not going to have any real effect, because what's going to happen is these people are going to raise their 10th Amendment claims, and then the court's going to say, well, under our reading of the Commerce Clause, or, well, under our reading of the Necessary and Proper Clause, or under our reading of, you know, the requirement that the president be at least 35 years old, Congress has power to do whatever it wants, including what it's doing to you, and so go to jail. In other words, most of us don't fall into the class that's going to be able to raise these appeals, and the appeals are going to be basically pointless anyway.
See, now there's the type of juicy tidbit I'm talking about. We are able to cram a couple of good things in here. Kevin, I don't know if you have any time. Are you able to stay on a couple more minutes after the break and take
yes.
a couple of calls?
Awesome. Yes, I am.
Thank you so much. Anybody want to call in? The number is 323-843-6008. You are listening to TRX. Oh!
Did you know you can track current nullification efforts and other legislation at 10thAmendmentCenter.com? Click on Legislative Tracking for all the up-to-date info. Transcend the perpetual ping-pong battle between the Democrats and the Republicans today. The transpartisan agenda of the 10th Amendment Center says we don't care who you voted for as long as you stand with us against big government. Join the movement today at 10thAmendmentCenter.com. That's 10thAmendmentCenter.com. The Peace President bombs. The TSA gropes and scams. The drug war rages on. The Fed prints and prints and prints. What do we do about it? At Nullify Now tour stops around the country, hear speakers like Tom Woods, Stuart Rhodes, Jim Babka, and many others. Learn about nullification and put it into practice right now. Visit nullifynow.com for more information. That's nullifynow.com. There's a fever sweeping the nation.
I got a fever, and the only prescription...
the Constitution. Citizens are standing up and demanding that the federal government abide by the Constitution. Do your part in this constitutional revival. Visit 10thAmendmentCenter.com/volunteer and plug in to the movement. You are listening to TRX on the 10th Amendment Center Radio Network.
They said, well, whenever we have an opinion from the court that provokes a political firestorm, we know that the court absolutely should not revisit its reasoning. Because if it ever were to reconsider what a lot of people think was an incorrect decision, it would undermine its own position in the structure of our government. And so just because we made this decision before and it was unpopular, we think that we should never revisit it. How's that for an argument?
That, of course, is the voice of our guest, Kevin Gutsman. I am Phil Rousseau with Michael Bolden on TRX, and Kevin Gutsman is the author of the book Virginia's American Revolution, which Tom Woods based his book Nullification on. Kevin's also the author of the Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution. And we were having all kinds of questions about constitutional law with Kevin Gutsman before the break, Michael Bolden.
Yeah, Kevin, you got a new book that you're working on. Can you tell us a little about that?
Actually, it's a biography of James Madison. It'll be published by St. Martin's Press next February.
Awesome. Phil, do we have a couple callers? We had a couple of questions coming in.
Yeah, I think we do. I think we're going to go to Ron in Georgia. Ron, you're up next on TRX. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Thank you. My question was directed at all of you, but clearly Kevin is very knowledgeable in the law. Thomas Jefferson said that it was in the right of the people, the individual, to withhold their monies from Congress if they saw that Congress was behaving in a manner that was outside of their constitutional delegated authority. Are we able to enforce that as individuals? Do we have that right?
Well, there's a difference between having a right and having it be a prudent thing to do. I would not counsel anyone to do that. That's a good way to find yourself becoming somebody's girlfriend. That is, I think the moment you try that, the IRS is going to be putting you directly into prison. And so don't do that. If you're unhappy with federal taxation, the proper response is through the electoral process, not by a scofflaw approach. So, no, I've never counsel anyone not to pay his federal taxes.
Ron, thanks so much for checking in on TRX. You know, it's funny because we were talking before the show, Michael Bolden, about my paycheck and noticing just how much today they take out in taxes, and it's very frustrating. We're going to go next to Dennis in Michigan. Dennis, you're up next on TRX. What's up, Dennis?
Thanks, Ben, and it's great to talk with you, Dr. Gutsman. Two questions, sir. First, in the previous administration, there was some discussion by the Vice President's office, Vice President Cheney, claiming, as I recall, that he was neither his office neither in the executive branch or the legislative branch. And I wonder what your thoughts were according to that particular Cheney doctrine, and also your thoughts on Article 3, Section 3. I believe that's the definition of treason, and then how that would relate to Abraham Lincoln and certain other American presidents. Thank you.
Oh, well, of course, the first thing is that Vice President Cheney was mistaken, and that the Vice President is the President of the Senate. So he was understood from the beginning as being in the legislative branch. Now, it happens that in case of the President's decease during his term in office, the Vice President assumes the powers of the President, but it's only in that situation that he takes on executive powers. We've come to take for granted these days that the Vice President will have a role in the President's administration because there's been a kind of informal delegation of authority to Vice Presidents, starting especially with President Carter and Vice President Mondale. But that's not really constitutional. That's really just the President's decisions that they have thought that these men ought to be their significant advisors or proxies at state funerals and that kind of thing. Anyway, Cheney was just mistaken, and actually Vice Presidents are in the legislative branch.
Kevin, I had another question that came through to us on Facebook, and I think maybe you'll get a chuckle about this one. But the question was, we had a lot of people vote on this, so I guess a lot of people aren't clear. Is the Constitution a living, breathing document? Like, what's the response that people should give? If you're going to give a constitutional nugget, how do you tell people or educate people on responding to that question?
Well, okay, if you ask me, is it a living, breathing document? I will say certainly it's been treated that way since at least 1937. Now, when somebody says that it ought to be a living, breathing document, what he really means is that it should be treated as dead, because what he's saying is that it shouldn't have any fixed meaning, but its meaning should change with the times. And if you recall that the only function of a written constitution is to limit the power of people in office, and you think about the fact that if anybody's deciding what changes are going to be required by the times, it's going to be people in office. If people in office are deciding that the Constitution has changed to allow them to do whatever they want, then the Constitution cannot serve its only function, which is to limit the power of people in office. That's, of course, the situation we've come to be accustomed to. So, for example, since World War II in particular, presidents have launched many wars without ever getting Congress to declare war, and we now take more or less for granted that they're going to do this. Recently, we had President Obama launch a war in Libya and repeatedly flout Congress's authority, which is supposed to be to have initiated any non-defensive military operation the United States might decide to undertake. People in Congress, including the Speaker of the House, have pointed out to the President that this is unconstitutional, and yet they are not employing the constitutional remedies they have at hand, including cutting off funding and ultimately impeaching people. They could start with the generals, and then they could work their way up to the secretaries, and finally they could go after the President, but they're doing nothing. And that's why we have a living, breathing, in other words, dead Constitution, one that office holders can flout. So the short of it is, you could tell people, yes, we do have a living, breathing Constitution, meaning a dead one, and no, that's not the way it's supposed to work. It's supposed to guarantee limits on people in office, and more or less that's what it ceased to do.
Well said, Kevin Gutzman. Hey, listen, man, thanks so much for spending some time with us tonight, and we're going to be looking forward to the new book on James Madison, and thanks for explaining some of the Supreme Court stuff to us.
I was very happy to be here.